Welcome to Underworld, a podcast all about crime all over the world. I'm your host, Sean Williams. Usually I'd be coming to you from a Berlin studio or an apartment, but right now I'm about 2 hours away from getting out of quarantine in a hotel somewhere outside Auckland, New Zealand. So I'm pretty happy about that. And a little caveat, if you hear our jailers wandering around outside the door, that's why. You can hear some background noise. So it's just a few days from Christmas, a time for giving and receiving joy and probably a bit of drunkenness and repressed family tensions. So why not help us receive some joy at the Patreon? We've got a bunch of interviews coming up for patrons, including from Mexico, and a follow-up from this episode I think will be really awesome. So check us out at patreon.com/theunderworldpodcast. Soon we'll have an episode from here with, hopefully, some reported stuff about Kiwi gangs, crimes, politics, all of that stuff. But today we're hopping across the Tasman Sea to Australia and an era that shocked Melbourne in the early 2000s. And my guest is someone today who knows Melbourne pretty well because he lives there, for one. He's sitting in Danny's chair, only like 10,000 miles away from New York. It's writer, comedian, actor. Is there more? Sammy Shah.
No, I think that should be it. That should cover it pretty much. I think actor is definitely a strong one. I don't think I've much done much of that, but yes, thank you.
Okay, cool. So, Sammy, tell us a bit more about yourself. Like, you've lived in Australia for quite some time now, right?
It's been almost a little over 8.5 years. So I got here in 2012. And early 2012, and I spent the first 3-4 years in WA, and then I moved across to Melbourne. So I've been in Melbourne for 5 years now, almost 6 at this point. And and being being someone, I used to be a journalist in Pakistan, and I used to be very much into just a person who's a bit of a nerd and a geek when it comes to things like crime and true crime and all that. So for me, coming to Melbourne, one of the first things I kind of immersed myself into was the true crime history of the city. It's just something I always find fascinating.
Is it quite a rough city? I mean, it sounds like it from the stuff I've been researching.
So there was definitely a period when it was. There was definitely a period in the early 2000s and the late 90s, particularly when there was a massive spike in mafia-related crime issues. There's still issues with bikie gangs or biker gangs, as they call them, the rest of the world. Every now and then, of course, you'll have some. And there's smaller gang activity, the same way there is in most places in the world. It's definitely, and if you ask Melburnians, because a lot of them are spoiled by having lived here their whole lives, they'll go, oh my god, there's so much crime, and there's African gangs everywhere, which is just a bunch of teenagers from African backgrounds hanging out. There's no African gangs. So it's just stupid things like that. When overall, when you come from a country with properly high crime rates, you're like, this place is pretty much heaven.
I mean, so it's Melburnian, right? Just so I've got that correct. All right, well, we're going to go back to 2010, April 2010 for the start of this. So Obama's the president, Haiti's just had a massive earthquake, and those Chilean miners, you remember them? They got saved. Yeah. So across in Australia, the bloodiest era in the country's organised crime era is about to come to a close in the way it began, with extreme violence. Carl Williams, this paunchy, so-called smiling assassin, he's sitting down at his prison desk to read the paper. And one of his cellmates, Matthew Johnson, this hulking, bald criminal with a history of violence, walks up behind Williams and he just casually beats him to death with the stem of a workout bike. So that's where this this story ends, really. The Aussie press is in uproar and they call it, in typical style, a bashing death. A few grisly blows. One of the maddest and weirdest characters in the mob history of Melbourne, Australia's biggest city, is dead. And with him, a police corruption case that rocks the entire country for years. So before I started researching this, I had pretty much no idea about Australian organised crime at all. I knew there were connections with the Italian mafia, and I knew about the Aussie bikies, the biker gangs you just mentioned, actually. They were shipping meth over from Southeast Asian kingpins. But beyond Ned Kelly, Chopper and Steve Smith, I didn't know much about crime on Aussie soil. There was a cricket joke in there, so sorry to our American listeners. And another thing, Cole Williams, who we're getting into this episode, this guy who kind of came out of nowhere to run Melbourne's underbelly, as people called it at the time. He's got exactly the same name as my dad, by the way. And his dad, who's this old-time drug dealer crook called George Williams, that's my dad's dad's name too. So, yeah, I remember we got stuck in JFK once on holiday to New York years and years ago, and my dad was saying something about cops having him on a blacklist at customs or something. So unless my old man's a liar and a drug baron or something, I reckon that was maybe because of this guy. Plus, I don't think the Americans could really tell ours and the Aussies' accents apart anyway. So, yeah, Carl and George Williams. That's pretty weird.
It's definitely the most Carl Williams, particularly, as we'll find out, is, you know, basically a psychopath in terms of the amount of people he killed and stuff. It's the most benign and mild serial killer mass murderer name in history, I think. No one ever suspects a guy named Carl Williams of having killed lots of people and selling drugs.
Yeah, I mean, and to look at the guy, right, he doesn't exactly look like your classical description of a kind of hood. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Australia's, yeah. He looks very much like a real estate agent, you know, and like a crap one at that, not even a good one.
Right. So I'm going to set the scene, that, I mean, with Melbourne, it's the capital of Victoria, which is, I mean, I guess it's probably the world's greatest sporting city, right? I mean, you've got the Aussie rules and the cricket. You've got the Aussie Open tennis, the Grand Prix.
It definitely takes sports very, very seriously. It's also the most livable city in Australia and the second most livable city in the world. Although this was all pre-COVID, so I don't know where the standings are now.
What's it like there at the moment? Because I know you had some issues with guards at the hotels having some happy times with the people in quarantine.
It turns out that was nonsense. Like, it actually never happened, and it was just so the whole thing about a security guard having sex with someone in quarantine was just someone had made a joke on social media, and Rupert Murdoch's journalists who work for News Corp over here are incapable of understanding satire. It's that part of their brain just never developed. And so they just assumed that it was real and ran it as a news story for such a prolonged period of time that everyone started believing it until other news outlets had to do proper investigation and go, nah, this is just nonsense. Like, you guys are complete idiots. So, it spread because of just, you know, bad handling of quarantine because of privatization and all those other basic issues that are ruining the world.
Yeah.
But no, we were in 7 months of lockdown, and now we're out, and we have zero cases now for over a month and a half. So, you know, we put in the hard yards, but it worked.
Yeah, and I'm sitting here in Auckland about to come out of quarantine myself. So this is another country that's done pretty well. But that's such a shame that story wasn't true. I thought it was like the most Australian story I've ever heard.
Absolutely, we were all thrilled about it. We were all, you know, we're like, if this is why we're in 7 months lockdown, at least it was worth it for someone, you know. But it turns out the whole thing is nonsense.
Oh god. Well, I mean, in case people don't know, Australia is pretty bloody big. So the biggest state, Western Australia, is about a quarter the size of the entire US. And I think Victoria is twice the size of New York State. So Australia's big, basically. And I remember when I was in Burma covering drug crime out there, like, the cops were telling me from Australia that they have such a hard time catching anything because you can pretty much just land your boat anywhere on the coast and there's just too much of it for anyone to cover the whole thing. So, I think there's a big sort of meth epidemic in Australia right now from what I'm reading, right?
There has been problem. For a while. There's ICE is just because it's relatively cheap to make and you know, there is increasing poverty, which is largely one of the reasons why something like ICE addiction takes place, as well as an increase in opiate addiction and stuff. We're seeing kind of a upwards trend in ICE addiction the way they did in America in maybe I'd say the early 2000s, and they didn't get it under control there, and it doesn't seem like we're doing a good job of getting it under control here either.
Right, and we're going to get into a bit of that further down the story, but yeah, I mean, Melbourne, to kind of tell you what Melbourne was like, it was a bit like New York in the early 20th century by the sounds of it. It was like a city of immigrants, mostly from Europe, coming to take over the land of indigenous people that the British had committed terrible acts of cruelty to. So basically the same as America, I guess. and in 1922, there's a ship called the Re d'Italia that rocks up at Melbourne port, and it unloads a bunch of Italian migrants looking for a better life, so the story goes. It's also carrying three members of the Calabrian and Ndrangheta mafia, and they quickly set up shop in their new home. So just like there were five criminal families in the US, the Gambinos and the Bananas and so on, there were seven in Australia. and they mostly made their money at Melbourne's fruit and veg markets, extorting local sellers and making them pay pizza or a levy on their food. So these were nice guys, and they also sold weed, good old weed. So this group of families, they just get more and more powerful, and Australia in its modern form is a pretty new place, so the infrastructure can't keep up with these old suited and booted mobsters from southern Italy who have been learning their trade for ages. They call this amalgam the Honoured Society, by the way, which is one of the Italian names for the mafia in Calabria. And they're still, from what I can see, they're still in partial control of the black markets today. So it wasn't just Italians.
Sorry to interrupt you, but there's definitely suburbs of Melbourne that are still, have if not as heavy, but definitely a mild kind of level of control by the Calabrian mafia here. I don't know if people even know about Calabria that much and how powerful the mafia still is there compared to other parts of Italy. Like, we always hear about Sicily and stuff, but if you go to Calabria, apparently, it's an extremely powerful organization there where you can't even mention it without getting into trouble. And the reason I know this is because my ex was a Calabrian Italian, and her family, which lives here, although most of them were born, the parents and everyone, aunts and uncles, were all born in Calabria and then came across in the 60s and 50s. They are all still tangentially related to the Calabrian mafia in terms of, every now and then boxes of cheese and olive oils will just pop up in their homes and be like, oh, someone brought a gift and it fell off the back of a truck. And you're like, oh boy.
And so you really do, I mean, it's really kind of a strong presence still today then.
I mean, it's definitely here. It's just not, and we've had a few weird crime things. There was, I was, prior to this, I just moved suburbs, but I used to live in a suburb called Brunswick. And Brunswick is where some of the Carlton crew shootings and killings that we hear about in a bit, no doubt, took place. And the main thing over there now is that this still is, like, some shops, particularly the Italian shops, do have to pay kickbacks and protection money to the mafia. There have been wiretaps of people, talking about how they control the streets of Melbourne. And a few, I think about a year and a half ago or a year ago, a flower seller was accidentally gunned down in a hit that was meant to get someone else, and they got the wrong guy. And that was still a mafia-related hit. But, it's one of those things where, this is one case that took place out of, a year of, crime, which had nothing to do with them. So they're definitely a diminished presence, and that's largely down to the Melbourne gangland killings.
Okay. So I'm going to do a little shout-out for some of the reading material that I've gone through. There's a really good documentary called Dead Famous, which goes into all of the history that we're going to get into. And then someone's made this great blog called Mafia Australia, which is like this real deep, granular look into all this stuff going back like a century. And then while I'm giving a few shout outs, Adam Shand, this true crime writer in Australia, he's done a book called Big Shots about the gangland killings. He's written about Mark Chopper Reed, who's this kind of psycho gangster that people might remember from the film with Eric Banner. He's written about Carl Williams, so he's really like the authority on this stuff, and he's written some great books. Anyway, so you've got Italian mobsters ripping off markets, and there are Irish gangs as well, and they're based mainly down on the waterfront where the painters and dockers unions are based. And so, like everywhere, all the dodgy shit's coming in on the boat, so the real scraps were had down there. But there seemed to be a high value on honour, at least the kind of honour that means you don't just gun people down all day long. This is relative, of course. And so this honoured society is growing, mostly in Sydney and Melbourne. And these cities are melting pots for people all over the world. When Godfather Domenico the Pope Italiano and Antonio the Toad Barbaro both die of natural causes. I know, right? They die in 1962, and it sparks a gang war for control of Melbourne. And I was going to say, get used to the nicknames, because this being an Aussie episode, almost everyone's got one, right?
Well, but it's not really a clever nickname. Australians are notorious for just shortening every word and adding an O at the end of it, and considering that their work done for the day. So instead of Sammy, it'll be Samo, or instead of having a banana, it'll be having a banno or something, unimaginative nonsense like that. So the fact that they actually went to the limits of actually calling that guy Toad means someone put in time, effort, concentration, thought, And they came up with that, which means he should be flattered. And that was pretty much everyone checked out for the day after that.
Do you reckon someone tried to make the argument that he should be flattered to be called the Toad?
Well, he obviously allowed it, and this is a mafia boss, so we're assuming for some reason he thought it was okay. I'm not sure why.
True, true. Maybe he's just really enlightened and he knows himself. He's been getting on that therapy. Yeah,
yeah, that's what they're known for, the love of therapy, yes.
Definitely, yeah, yeah. So in this 60s kind of mini gang war, the media calls it the Victoria Market murders. It seems like shotguns were the favoured weapons, especially from behind, which is supposedly a traditionally disrespectful death in Calabrian history. After all of it, this family called the Benvenutos comes out on top, led by the patriarch Liborio, who's this mustachioed kind of pint-sized Burt Reynolds-looking market stall owner. This guy rules like a king, and his daughter Angela marries Alfonso Muratore, which is who's the son of Vincenzo Muratore, who was shot dead in the battle. So they lived down the street, and there was relative peace in the underbelly for a while. Not far away, across town, another crime dynasty is being formed. Lewis Moran and Graham Kinneberg, who's called the Munster from Melbourne's Irish contingent, were pals from the Painters and Dockers Union, which was known throughout the 60s and 70s for a ton of criminal stuff, and it led to a Royal Commission. It's a bit like how the Yakuza started out, actually. It's similar to that. We've done another episode on that. But Moran and Kinneberg built a small criminal empire and piled up with the Colton crew, another local Italian mafia, which was enemies with the Honor Society. So you were mentioning a minute ago, right? They're based in this kind of area that's known as Little Italy, apparently.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of suburbs in Melbourne that have an Italian communities there, an Italian settlement over here. Brunswick is one of them. There's Carlton. There's at Carlton's Lodge where the mafia gets its name from. But you know, they expand all the way out to Reservoir and Sunshine and all these other suburbs. It's mostly the northern suburbs of Melbourne, and the unions back then, particularly the Painters and Dockers Union, was made up of Irish, Irish waterfront workers, and then also the Italian Calabrian mafia kind of people, and they worked together to kind of set up a mafia crew. That was actually largely the Morans that you mentioned weren't of Calabrian background. They were Italians, but I don't think they were Calabrian.
I think they were Irish, right?
And yeah,
so
that's
they
right.
They were working with the Irish down the docks.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, they
teamed
were Irish.
Up with the Italians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then. And you get these underbelly figures called Mike Gatto, who's going to come up a bit later, and then this guy called Alphonse Gangitano, which
Gangitano.
Is
brilliant. Oh, it's a hard
Gangitano,
G at the
stop, sorry.
And then a soft G in the middle, yes.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Alphonse. But so things plod along between these groups, and there's the odd sprout of violence, but mostly business is good, the Pizzo's doing okay, and the factions keep mostly to themselves. Quote, the Honor Society was never quite as big as influential as in Australia as people thought, says a former policeman. This guy's called Brian the Skull Murphy. So even the cops have got pretty scary nicknames in Australia. He continues, Benvenuto had to cast a big shadow to maintain the status quo. This occasionally had to be backed up by action, lest the aura of power diminish. To get the young Italians to show loyalty to him required a fear of the unknown. So he's talking the talk, but maybe not walking so many walks at this time. But Liborio dies in 1988, and instead of his son Frank, he grooms this dashing lawyer called Joseph Pino Acquara to take over. I looked up Pino, by the way, it just means pine tree. So
oh,
it's not
really?
Quite the skull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually a gentle and quite lovely nickname.
Yeah, this guy's like all pinstripe suits and sort of coiffured hairdo, so he's kind of a slicker side of the business.
Yeah.
Acquirer is clever and he knows the law and how to get around it. Liborio's no fool, basically. In 92, revenge murders account for Frank and Alphonse Muratore. But by and large, that's how things were panning out. And the Honor Society and Carlton crew, they're getting along pretty much okay. It's when drugs come along, really, in a big way that things change. So, especially with heroin and meth, you've got Vietnamese and Chinese gangs bringing them over, and there's speed by the bikers. And I think it seems like the bikers are used as kind of couriers for the bigger crime syndicates, right? It seems like they're just the kind of foot soldiers, or how does that kind of work?
Well, I mean, yeah, basically they're they've got their own bikey gangs and everything, and they're not really they exist in their own world, and they've got their own drug cartels and their own revenue streams and everything, but yeah, they do work with the mafia as the on the ground guys, because obviously they're more intimidating, they're more violent, they've got literally giant bikes that they ride around in, so they make for a good PR move.
Are they big? Do you see them around? Like, do they make the news?
Not really. I mean, there are suburbs again where you might see them, and it'll be the seedy part of the suburb and stuff. But Melbourne cops have done a very good job in the last decade or so of kind of pushing a lot of this stuff out. And shutting it down, and at the very least, like, you still hear about bikey wars or bikey fights and stuff, but it's very minimal at this point.
Right. So the weed in Australia is mostly being dished out by the Italians, as it has been for years. And what's important is that there's new party drugs. So ecstasy is going wild in the 90s. Obviously, there's rave culture all over the world, and that's when we get to 1999 and Carl Williams. So it might be obvious by now, we've just spoken about it, but Carl Williams kind of comes out of left field altogether, right? And a news guy told an ABC crew that, quote, Carl was a supermarket shelf stacker and not a particularly good one, but along the way he learned that there was more money in drugs. So, yeah, I mean, you've got these kind of picture-perfect gangster-looking guys on the Italian and Irish sides. There's all these suits and slick back hair and tacky jewellery, shiny shoes, the whole works. This is especially the case of Alphonse Gancitano, by the way, who's tall, built, fond of a suit and sunglasses combo. It'd be hard to pick him out of a Sopranos lineup, basically. In fact, one cop says that, quote, the Melbourne lot thought the Sopranos was a documentary, which is kind of what I feel about it since Danny described growing up in New York. But anyway, so there you've got this kind of this whole scene going on, you know. I think it's quite regimented and it's full of this tradition and so-called honour. And then this kind of weird guy just shows up, and the cops at this time, this is kind of mad, they're not really helping the scene out at all. They buy chemicals at wholesale and they sell them on the black market, and they call it controlled delivery. I'm not really sure what their end goal is there.
Basically, there's a long history of Melbourne policing and Victoria police. And I'm sure it's largely the same in the whole country, which is what happens when you've got cops who don't have to deal with very intense levels of crime, that they don't really, they're not very good at that. And what ends up happening here is that they just crap at their job, you know, largely. if what's required of them is just pepper spraying and beating a whole bunch of activists trying to stop a refugee from being taken from one detention center to another, because that's a human rights violation, the cops are phenomenal. They will dress up into the nines, they'll put all kinds of protective gear on, helmets and bulletproof shields and all kinds of vests and stuff, and they will pepper spray and baton beat the crap out of you. But when it came to just this, which was a fairly obvious crime story where, like, the names of all the major players was known, you know, everyone knew who was involved, who wasn't involved, everyone knew where to trace the money, even Carl Williams, who came out of nowhere a little bit, was, you know, a fairly big figure and a well-known figure by the end of it, and it took them ages to catch them. It took them absolutely ages because just basic policing was so outside their purview. So, you know, something like, you know, if you did The Wire in Australia, it would make the American version of The Wire with the Baltimore situation seem like a very successful series of arrests and very efficiently done, whereas the Melbourne one is like a more of a bumbling kind of buffoonery exhibition.
Yeah, a bumbling is, like, I think, a very kind term for the cops, because we're going to get into a lot of that in a moment as well. I mean, there is actually like a Wire style show about all this, right, called Underbelly.
Yeah, it's called Underbelly.
Sort of well known at the time.
It's not great. It's okay. There's some great acting in it, but it's very badly edited and produced and directed and stuff. And there's some bizarre, like, choices in that. And in that, they glorify the daylights out of the cops. You know, obviously, it's very much a police propaganda piece where, you know, the task force Piranha, which was kind of put together, is made to look like an amazing task force full of these super motivated individuals who, it turns out, were all fictional. because real cops would just slap shit at it. I mean, there's I don't know. Will you be covering the Nicola Gobble element of this?
Yeah, yeah, we're going to get to her soon.
I'm going to not get there right now. But she's the perfect example of how utterly terrible the police are.
Yeah, we don't have to be waiting for Gobbo. I was waiting for a reason to use that pun. Didn't Underbelly get in trouble for like following the story so to down to the wire that they were actually like in contempt of court for some of these things or something? I read
there's a lot of weird contempt of court rules in Australia. So for example, if you remember the Cardinal George Pell case that was a big deal in 2019, where a Catholic cardinal with the church was accused of child abuse and then found guilty in two cases, and then those were reversed later. But the entire world was reporting on it, but in Australia, media outlets were not allowed to even mention him by name because of privacy laws and stuff. So yeah, there's a lot of weird kind of regressive, very, very out of date privacy laws here.
Right. They just called him Cardi P or something.
Yeah.
So we've got this whole scene, and this guy comes onto the scene, and there's these cops. So they're doing this controlled delivery, and they're doing this so much that the police are actually the biggest customer for Sigma at the time, which is this leading pharma firm. As you can imagine, this genius brain idea doesn't work that well and just kind of floods Melbourne with drugs. I had a little note at this point saying, believe it or not, this is the least shit thing the Victoria Police do in this story. But Alphonse, he wants to be the kind of big man in Melbourne, the godfather. And Jason Moran, son of Lewis, has other ideas. And he goes to Alphonse's home for a chat, pulls a handgun and shoots Alphonse dead. So there's chaos in the underbelly and the cops are pretty much pushing it along themselves. And at the same time, this dumpy butt-chin guy called Carl Williams is cornering the party drug scene by pressing so-called dog tablets, which is a mixture of ketamine and pseudo, apparently. And they branded these pills FUBUs or UFOs. They don't sound like a lot of fun, to be honest, but him and his dad, George, make a packet selling it with the help of the bikies, and they undercut the underbelly with George. George is kind of this small-time crook, right? He's called the gangsters called him a shit man, which is a nobody, right? I guess you didn't need the translation. And so Carl doesn't look like these other gangsters at all. He's kind of fat and he's got frosted tips and sunglasses. They look like they've come from some cheapo beach hut. They call him the smiling assassin, but he could more accurately be called the most bogan gangster ever. Am I getting bogan?
You are, right? Well done, right. Correct, yeah. Although you might have to translate bogan for the non-Aussie listeners.
Yeah, what is it like, a sort of redneck or a hick?
It's like a hick, not even a redneck so much as just like a hick. And the idea is that there's obviously a lot of classism involved in that. You know, it's just someone who is very, very lower class in terms of financial income. And then there's the mullet, and then there's the addiction to doing burnouts in a ute and eating meat pies and having VB beer for breakfast. And so, yeah, it's very much a lifestyle choice.
Okay, sounds great. I think he looks a bit like a Aussie Guy Fieri, so that was where I was trying to draw the line with America.
I would say Guy Fieri still has a bit of pizzazz. Carl Williams, like, if you look at his pictures, if he walked into the room with three other people, he's the one you would not notice. And I think maybe that's what kind of worked in his favor in the end, the fact that he's utterly, utterly forgettable.
Yeah, he keeps wearing these kind of oversized shirts and like leather jackets, I thought, were cool and made me look grown up when I was like 14.
Right.
There's a great quote from Mark Reed, by the way, Chopper, who people should definitely look up if they don't know who he is. He says, quote, "To get anywhere in the criminal world, you had to fucking fight. Then along came drugs and you didn't have to be able to fight anymore. The village idiots and town mice were becoming drug lords."
He sounds so upset about that.
I know, it's really pissed him off.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Williams' upbringing is pretty tough. He grows up in West Melbourne and gets into drugs early. Is West Melbourne bad? Is that a bad place?
Not anymore. But yeah, apparently it was at one point. Long before
right.
I
is
got
it kind
here.
Of like hipster gentrified it's, these days?
Everything is hipster gentrified these days. It's basically, West Melbourne is now where you would get avocado on toast. But back then, I'm sure it was more frightening.
Right, right. So Williams' older brother, Shane, dies of a heroin overdose in 97. But it doesn't seem to have put Carl off the industry at all. And when brothers Jason and Mark Moran pay Williams to do a pill job for them, he doesn't mix the binding agent properly, apparently, and the pills just go to shit. It's not clear whether he did this on purpose or by accident, but you can imagine these old grizzled docker gangsters aren't too happy with him at this point. So they set up a meeting in 99 with Williams on this little empty patch of green in a suburb. An argument breaks out and Jason pulls out a 22 pistol and he threatens Williams. Mark at this point orders Jason to shoot Williams in the head, but Jason instead puts one in his beer belly because he didn't know how he'd get his money back with a dead Williams. So this moment here, when he's getting shot in this tiny little park, this is when the Melbourne gangland war really kicks off in earnest. And Williams, this cheery-faced, kind of dopey-looking guy, he wants revenge. A guy who's called Mr. X, who's this underworld figure who gets in with Williams at the time and later testifies against him. We're going to get into him as well in a moment. He says that Williams would rant and rave about the Moran family, saying, quote, "I want them... I want every one of them dead and every one of their crew dead." So I guess that's pretty clear.
And they had wiretaps going on a lot of this stuff. So they had the recordings of them saying this. I don't know why they decided not to act at the time.
There's another story with a bug later on. I think one of the police puts it in a car and it causes the brake lights to flicker.
Yes.
But it's catching like every single thing. It's like they've got every single thing on record at this point and no one's getting arrested at all. So yeah, it just keeps on happening. And so Williams recovers from his gunshot wound and he gets straight back to pressing those pills. Soon after, cops find him and George in their house and Carl's asleep, tucked up in bed. And his pill press is just going like the clappers, working on a job worth over 15 million Australian dollars, apparently. I think it's like 75 US cents to an Aussie dollar. So I guess that's
yeah,
10
right.
million bucks. So that's a decent amount of money for a little homespun pill press. The police, obviously, they throw Williams in jail and he meets a guy called Victor Brincat. So this guy is called The Runner because he does bank jobs with his getaway car parked miles away and he runs to it instead of getting straight in the car. Again, sounds very Aussie to me.
like it sounds like a terrible, terrible plan, but for some reason
he made
it work as a shtick. Like it became his thing, you know?
I know. The thing I do is I go on foot and then get in a car. That's great, yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, wow, this guy's the Riddler of Melbourne.
Genius. But, I mean, this guy's going to be involved in a very big way. So Williams offered this guy 70 grand to off the Moran brothers. And soon after he gets out on bail himself, and then all hell breaks loose, right? So Jason Moran at this time, he swerves his first wave of violence because he's actually chucked in jail himself over a massive nightclub brawl. But his brother, not so much. So there have been a bunch of killings at this point, drug war, drive-bys, execution-style shootings. But on June 15th, 2000, Carl Williams steps it up. He ambushes Mark Moran in his car outside his luxury mansion and he shoots him dead. Moran had been under police surveillance, of course, but cameras had been switched off before the murder. And this is the only one of the gangland killings, I believe, where Williams actually pulled the trigger himself. But for him, things are on the up. He marries Roberta Merciera, an ex-wife of one of the Morans and a convicted drug dealer in 2001. So that's going to make everyone happy. And in the same year, he had a kid with her and they called her Dakota. So then Jason Moran gets out of prison. But rather than get out while everyone's getting killed, he decides he's going to take over the family business, which is a bad idea. Brincat gets out of prison himself and the murders continue. In 2002, a police informant is shot in the chest and head while wearing a wire and he survives. By this time, there have been 20 murders in 6 years and the police are the ones who haven't been paid off, don't really know what to do. Like you said, I think they're just kind of bewildered at this point, right?
And it's remarkable because, like, how many people survive shootings that, you know, that the Carl Williams shot in the gut, no problem. This police informant shot in the face and body, no problem. Walks it off. And you're just like, okay, so even the gangsters aren't that good at doing what they're supposed to do. This shouldn't be so hard to catch them.
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, but some of the cops definitely do know what they're doing. So at this time, and they're not doing the right thing, shall we say. But then the next year, in 2003, something really shocking happens. So Jason Moran and his minder, Pasquale Barbaro, no nickname, sorry, Pasquale, are waiting outside an Ozkick clinic.
God, that is Ozkick clinic. Yeah, it's a soccer camp, that's all.
Right, so it's like quick cricket or touch football or something like that.
It's just football. It's what in America it's called soccer, which is, you know, just football in the rest of the world. And it's basically like an indoor version of that. And then they do outdoor as well, with slightly modified rules for kids and stuff.
I see. All right. So these guys, they're in a blue Mitsubishi wagon with about 7 kids in the back. And Brinkat and a guy's cops are going to call the driver, walk up to the van and blow Moran and Barbara away with, yep, shotguns. Then Brinkat runs off, of course.
Yeah, that's his thing.
Of course, yeah. And then he meets Williams to tell him the job's done. So we know he tells Williams the job's done because we've got it all on records. Mm-hmm. So this point, Williams makes a pretty weird decision. So he stiffs the assassins. He gives Brinkat an envelope with $2,000 in it and nothing to Mr. X, or the driver, sorry. So that's a cracking idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So either way, a killing like that in front of kids in broad daylight, tons of witnesses, this changes the whole thing for the police and the media. And one lawyer tells ABC, quote, "Previously people were murdered in their driveways, in their cars at night, and now you've got normal suburban families going to an Ozkick clinic," I got it right that time, "seeing two people being brutally murdered in front of their own children." And then another murder cop says simply, "Crooks don't do things like that." So this is like a major turning point.
Yeah, it's a massive escalation at this point. It's it caught everyone by surprise. Apparently, the cops were out. I spoke to at the ABC when I was working there. Some of the guys who covered this beat were people that were my colleagues, and they used to tell me stories about how this was an unprecedented thing. Like, no one had seen any, you know, it was the 9/11 of Victorian Police and Crime Association.
Right. And so, yeah, about the same time, this thug guy from the neighborhood called Andrew Benji Veniamin, he's hired to take out Williams and his family. And he takes an accomplice along and he waits on the roof of their home. But the story goes that when Veniamin sees Roberta breastfeeding Dakota, he can't bring himself to carry out the hits.
Yep.
And then he weirdly becomes Williams's best friend and confidant.
Yep.
And Dakota even calls him Uncle Andrew. So that's a nice, sweet, happy story.
Yeah, he ends up having what many believe is an affair with Carl Williams' wife. She calls him her soulmate. And he was also my ex's family's friend. Like, apparently, when I was watching the Underbelly TV series, and the actor who plays Carl Benjamin kind of walks in and out of the screen, and one of my ex's aunties walked into the room at that point and said, "Yeah, we remember him. He used to come around all the time. He was a lovely guy." And I'm like, "Great, awesome!
Oh my God.
I am in a wonderful place right now."
Wow! I didn't realize you were that close to this story.
Neither did I until it started happening. And it takes a lot for a guy from Pakistan, particularly Karachi, to feel unsafe. And in that moment, I definitely did.
So until this point, cops really hadn't joined the dots with all these killings, and it seems like despite all of the wiretaps and everything, they're still not kind of fingering Williams as the main guy involved in all of them. Maybe they just think he's too much of this happy-go-lucky idiot.
I think it was just for them, just like everyone else, it was just too hard to believe. You know, every time they'd be like, "Oh, it's definitely Williams," then someone would pull up a photograph and they'd be like, "Can't be. Look at him. Look at the frosted tips. Look at the ill-fitting suits. Like, it's got to be someone better than this."
It's like this overweight 90s boy band guy. He can't be killing everyone. So in 2003, Victoria Police, I guess they're under a lot of pressure by now, and they launched this task force called Purana, which isn't the fish, but P-U-R-A-N-A, which is, I looked it up, it's an ancient collection of Sanskrit literature.
It's really strange.
On the force been brushing up, or?
It's really strange because Purana in Urdu and in Hindi just means old. So, and I can't really find other meanings for it. So basically, they're like, yeah, we'll have a task force and we'll call it old, I guess.
So someone on the task force knows Urdu or Hindi.
Yeah, Hindi or Sanskrit. But either way, they were poorly placed in their job. Like, they should have had some
incredibly literary.
So these guys then begin building this idea of Williams's drug empire and Brincat. But there's trouble on that horizon too, and we're going to find out in a moment. But meanwhile, it just becomes the Carl Williams show. He doesn't mind speaking to the media. He takes to calling himself the Premier. Quote, he got bigger and bigger and greedier, as they tend to do, one police officer says. So now we're getting to the real dark meat of the gangland killings, I guess. In 2003, cops bug a car. Yes, this is the car that's being driven by Brincat. But yeah, this thing makes the brake lights flicker and the crooks find it. Anyway, So this is something I didn't understand. They bring the bug to Williams and he brushes it off and says he'll, quote, do the job anyway. So they've got him with this bug and he still says something on record. Just kind of shows you the brazenness of how it's getting at this point.
I think brazen is the wrong word there. I think the intense stupidity of everyone involved.
Stupidity. So while police are floundering around trying to figure out what that actually means, Brincat guns down Michael Marshall, who's this hot dog vendor and drug dealer. I guess he was probably making more from one of those jobs than the other. But they do it next to his five-year-old son, so it's pretty grim. And it's and anyway, Brincat runs home as he wants to do. And for some reason, he calls Williams and he tells them in a pretty slack code that a horse he likes has been, quote, scratched. So there's your criminal mastermind. Yep. Yeah, I guess you are right. Yeah, it's less brazen than idiotic. Anyway, so the cops pick this conversation up and they take them both into custody. So finally, they've got off their arse and done something. Williams then distances himself from Brincat. And when Brincat begs him to at least look after his own mum, Williams wires her just a few grand. So he's shortchanged him again. And now, unsurprisingly, he's going to bite him in the backside in a little bit. So now we get to this really strange period in the killings. In September that year, the home of a notorious drug smuggler called Tony Mockbell is broken into by a small-time mobster called Terry Hodson and this ponytail cop, and they take a bunch of money and guns. And there's a great quote from the officer who gets called to the scene. I wish I could do this in an Aussie accent. He says, I thought, here we go. This is going to be an all-nighter. And I think it's part of an ABC program that I saw. It is brilliant when he says that. So this guy who's caught this cop is called David Michel, and he's actually supposed to be putting the house under surveillance, not robbing it. And Hodson is actually a police informer himself who's been ratting out his mates to Michel and Paul Dale, who's Michel's boss. So that might sound a bit fishy, to say the least. Later in 2003, police charged Dale, Michel and Hodson with the break-in, and they want to put Hodson into witness protection because he's obviously on a bunch of kill lists at this point. But Hodson's daughter's just had a baby and she refuses, and they carry on in their Melbourne home. So Hodson then tells the leader of Victoria's anti-corruption squad, Murray Gregor, no nickname again, sorry Murray, that Dale has been on the take from Carl Williams, and George Williams even tells him he's given Dale $6,000 at one point himself. Dale had also been trying to figure out the location of Jason Moran before the Mitsubishi killings, by the way, so this is all turning into a real web of dark shit. And then in 2003, December, Graham Kinneberg, who at this point is considered the city's biggest gangster, he's shot dead. His associate, Mike Gatto, accuses Veniman, who police believe has committed 7 murders at this point. Cops say Williams is next for the block. He says, quote, if anyone wants to come and get me, then come and get me. Just don't miss.
So at this point, he's very much kind of modeling himself after Al Pacino in what was the movie with the comical amounts of cocaine at the end of it?
Scarface.
Like he sees himself as a Scarface. This is going to be a great last stand. It doesn't work out that way, but that's very much what he's aiming for and hoping for, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it in March the next year, Gatto shoots Veniman around the back of a Carlton pizza joint, so that's very Godfather as well.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly, given he literally said he wanted to kill Veniman, a jury believes Gatto acted in self-defense and finds him not guilty of murder. That's pretty laughable.
Basically, everyone on the jury's last name was Audley Gatto as well, probably, or something.
Yeah. Orly the Mouth Ghetto. Yeah. So back to the cops. So Dale has got a bunch of Vice Squad colleagues to inform on the anti-corruption squad, which is pretty mad. And phone lines being tapped, they actually catch him reaching out to Williams at this time. But this info isn't obviously getting back to Gregor on the anti-corruption squad. This is crazy. And then on the eve of May 16th, 2004, police are called to Terry Hodson's home, where he and his wife, Christine, have been shot twice in the back of the head, execution style. Not only that, but the killer, and this is brazen, had picked up the empty shells and placed them on the bodies carefully. And secret police files on Hodson's snitching have been stolen from the station and leaked to folks in the underworld. So it's all gone a bit The Departed now, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of leaks, and those, though, by the way, those investigations are still ongoing to this day. Like, you still have Task Force Piranha, grand jury investigations taking place in Australia.
Right. So this stuff's still going on.
Well, it's mainly the level of infiltration into the cops, the amount of bribery that was involved and everything. That's still coming out. Yes.
Wow. Yeah, so it's gone a bit Departed, but this is actually going to get a bit crazier now. So now we're going to get into Nicola Gobbo. So she doesn't really need a nickname, I guess. She's been a star criminal defence lawyer in Melbourne for years.
She has a nickname, though. In Australian media, she was called Lawyer X for the longest time.
Lawyer X.
Yeah.
And I was reading about that, and actually the Victoria Police had tried to sort of muzzle the press and issue all these injunctions and stop them even calling her that.
Well, like, it's funny.
They really didn't want this out at all.
For example, when I first started looking into the story, it was right around the time the Lawyer X stuff was coming out, and I was working on radio at the ABC, and, when the first day that we kind of covered this Lawyer X thing, the cops said, you can't name her, and no one knows the name, no one knows who it is. All we know is their name is Lawyer X, and they were a major informant. And the text lines on the radio station went nuts, because every single listener was like, yeah, it's Nicola Gobbo. We all know it's Nicola. Everyone knows it's Nicola Gobbo. It's obvious. Like, it was crazy. The whole city of Melbourne knew the identity of Lawyer X, and the cops were pretending as if no one knew.
I remember the thing about Ryan Giggs sleeping with his brother's wife.
Yeah,
that seems
like
the same kind of thing. But yeah. So, Nicola Gobbo is this kind of like star criminal defence lawyer in Melbourne for years, and she's the daughter of this legal dynasty, high riser, the whole shebang. And she ends up representing, among others, Tony Mockbell, the guy whose house was burgled, and, yep, Carl Williams. And there's this actual picture of them together at a casino. It looks so small-time crook, it's really funny. So it turns out Mockbell is getting pissed off with Gobbo, and he starts threatening her. Then she goes to the police and offers to turn informant on her celebrity clients for them. At this point, you might assume the cops tell her to do one, right? Because she's a lawyer. It's highly morally improper for her to be passing on details of clients to police. We're learning that's not the way of Melbourne cops. So they sign her up. Where can you sign Nicola? And this war is raging on at this point. So Louis Moran, the patriarch of the family, he's killed in a shootout at Northern Melbourne Club. Italians are killing Irish killing Italians. All the time, Williams is making a packet and ordering these murders. Brincat, bless him, still hasn't turned on his absolute shit of a boss. He's in jail, but Williams selling him out eventually takes his toll, and Brincat sends a letter to the police. And when they ask him what he wants in return, he says, quote, I'd kill for a vanilla slice.
Of course.
So, yeah, why not, eh? He's got to keep that energy up for all the running. Jesus. I mean, it's kind of crazy, right? Like, So yeah, we'll jump toward to 2007 at this point. So Williams is actually sent down for three of the murders, and he gets off a fourth, although the true number of people he killed is probably quite a few more, and he gets 35 years. At this point, the Dale, the accused officer, he's in deep trouble, obviously. If Williams spills the beans about the Hodson couple's killing, he'll probably be screwed, although I probably should add at this point that he denies everything. And by the way, he's being represented by Nicola Gobbo. And she's having an affair with the assistant police commissioner, who's called Jeff Pope. And these names, these really don't need any nicknames at all at this point. And Williams has realised that Gobbo is the gob shooting her mouth to the police at this point, because she's been visiting all sorts of people in prison who aren't even their clients, and he can see. So this is just mad. And at one point, she breaks into the office of another lawyer. I think that is Zara.
Yep, maybe, that's right.
Yeah, and she finds a bunch of phone records that would have outed her at this point. So she slams the cops for their, quote, sloppy work. What do you think she wanted as payback? It wasn't a vanilla slice, no. But it was tickets to see Lionel Richie.
Well, look, to be fair, I think that's a good buy. Like, if you're going to get tickets for anything, I would say Lionel Richie is a concert that you definitely want to risk your life for. You know, at least it wasn't something crap.
Fair. Yeah, maybe I'm being too harsh on the rich. But so the tight's net, the net is tightening, obviously, on Gobbo and Dale at this point, and Williams realises, and he decides to turn Supergrass behind bars at Barwon Prison, which is near Geelong in Victoria. That's like, what, a short hour drive away from
easily.
Melbourne, I think?
Yeah, not far at all.
So he tells cops that under Dale's orders, he'd paid a small-time gangster called Rodney Collins to kill Terry and Christine Hodson. And that year, actually, off to the side a little bit, but still involved in Mafia, documents provided by Gobbo helped make the world's biggest ever ecstasy bust when 15 million pills hidden in 3,000 tins of tomato are stopped in New South Wales, where they're being brought in by the Honour Society Calabrian guys. And there's rumours that the Ndrangheta mobsters back in Italy still want people dead over that bust today. So she's got the goods, like, but she's a lawyer, so this is not going to end well.
Well, that's the problem. Yeah. Is she did a good job. It just wasn't her job to do at all.
Yeah, I mean, and she definitely knows what she's doing, right? So she says, quote, "I've chucked ethics out the window. I've chucked legal professional privilege out the window. I've chucked my career out the window. If any of this came out," she tells a handler, "she'd be so fucked it's not funny." So yeah, she knows exactly what she's doing now. So now we've got Williams in a high security prison singing about everyone in the underbelly. We've got Paul Dale sweating out a double murder charge. And we've got Nicola Gobbo getting increasingly wound up in all this dangerous informing, and she's getting death threats. And it's now 2010, and everyone in Melbourne's mafia is shitting bricks, basically, about what Williams is telling the police. One of its biggest players by this time is a guy called Rocco Arrico. And, of course, Paul Dale's entire case rests on Williams' testimony. Well, bad news for Williams. The two guys he's sharing a cell with, and this is this kind of big common room with cell rooms off to one side and a gym seating area. It looks quite nice, actually. I'm just trying to stoke the prisons of bloody cakewalk, guys, you know. So these two guys, one's an associate of Rocco Arrico, and the other is this big, scary guy called Matthew Johnson. Long history of violence, pretty nasty bloke. How he ended up in a cell with those two guys is just incredible. So one day in April 2010, Johnson walks up behind Williams while he's reading the paper, and he smashes his head in with the stem of the exercise bike. 10 minutes afterwards, the third cellmate calls up Arrico and tells him about it. Like, they just had open phone lines.
Yes, for some reason, there's no... there's no, you know... How in the start of Serial season one, you have that, you know, you've got a collect call from so-and-so prison. There's none of that here. It's just everyone's got a cell phone. They've got a good data plan. Yeah.
It's incredible. And this guy calls up Rocco Arrico, tells him the deed is done or whatever. And it's then another 17 minutes before the guards even realizes, like, if any guards realize what's going on. The anti-corruption cop at this point, Murray Gregor, he's just bewildered that this happened. Like, literally every single thing they could have done to protect Williams and Hodson has just been scuppered by their colleagues. And that's really the end of the Melbourne gang killings, really, because They all, obviously, with the biggest evidence against him, he's now 6 feet under. And by the way, he gets taken out in a gold coffin, so he keeps the look to the end.
Of course. With frosted dips on the coffin, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. So he gets off the charge, Dale. And Gobbo, she gets increasingly death threats, and the police aren't protecting her at all. She flees to another country with her kids. And until recently, she was there, I believe. And the Australian police said that if she returned, they'd take the kids off of her because of the danger she was under. So they really did a number on her.
Mm-hmm.
And like you were saying, there's tons of inquiries about police corruption in the last few years, and it seems that the cops are trying to scupper that too. And then what's more, because the evidence supplied by Gobbo was clearly tainted, a bunch of guys have already got off their charge. So yeah, a complete shit show, basically.
Yeah,
and there you have it. That's the Melbourne gangland case.
One of the guys you mentioned, Tony Mockbell, he's in prison, but he's been, contesting his conviction because he says that the way that the police got the information on which to arrest him, that is in and of itself illegal because it came through Gobbo. So she basically compromised the whole case, and the reason why the police were so desperate to use her because they had no other ways of bringing these guys in, and so they went with the extreme option. Except when you look at the court coverage and the police investigation, there were a million other ways to bring these guys in. The wiretaps, for example, or the eyewitness accounts or any of those things. They just were either so compromised by corruption themselves or were just so utterly terrible at their jobs that they never bothered bringing anyone in properly.
It doesn't sound like a lot has changed since either, right?
Well, I mean, basically, the one thing that's changed is either the mafia and everyone have really gone underground and done a better job of hiding themselves, or the cops have, I think basically what ended up happening is this whole Melbourne gangland killings was such a high profile event. It worked badly for not just the police, but also for the mafia. You know, they don't want to be, this isn't the Sicilian mafia, which has a more prominent public profile, even in Italy, and if you go out to places like New York and all these places, the Sicilian mafia are media figures. We always know their names. We always know their personalities and all that stuff. The Calabrian mafia is very low key. They don't like being talked about. They don't like being in the press. And so that's how they exert their power, is by being the invisible hand. And so the fact that this was such a high profile thing, I think for them was a lesson in decorum and a lesson in restraint. And you've seen a bit of that now.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, that kind of brings us full circle. Does that sound like the city you know and love, Sammy?
Honestly, it does not sound like the city I know and love now. It's very much the past of Melbourne, and it is something that's a big part of the past of Melbourne. You know, like when... you can go to the areas now, but there's for example, one of the Moran, the elder of the Moran family was shot in the Brunswick pub, which you can go into and just see if you want the Oz Kicks clinic where those guys were shotgun to the face while there were seven kids in the back seat. That's near where I'm living right now. So that is very much still there. The history of it's there, and you're aware of that history, but it's so different in terms of a lot of it's like if you go to Times Square now, or in the last 20 years, and you see this kind of Disneyfied version of Times Square, which used to be a really seedy place in the 80s and 90s. 80s and 90s New York, Times Square was just peep shows and drug deals and things like that. And now it's this wonderful place where you can take awesome photographs. And that's what's happened. It's been like the gentrification of Melbourne has kind of pushed all of that underground and out of sight. And Melbourne is such a great, such a modern, such a livable city with such a good reputation for peace and low crime that I think it works in everyone's favor to maintain that.
Okay, so the Tourism Board of Victoria State are going to be very happy with that. That's the final parting advert for them.
They took a beating because of COVID lockdown. So, yeah, I'm sure they'd be thrilled to hear that they're doing a lot better now.
Cool. Well, Sammy, thanks ever so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Yeah,
it's been a ride talking about this. Cheers. And, don't forget, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, our website, Patreon, obviously, and all of that good stuff. So, thanks again, and we'll see you soon.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.